From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, when the House leaves for their traditional August break, well, the Senate will be left behind. They'll be working through the month of August, primarily on confirmations like that of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, will be here in just a moment with an update on that confirmation. And another significant day here in the nation's capital as the first ever Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom came to an end. But the work just begins as nations across the world literally committed to confront religious persecution. We'll talk about that with Mick Mulvaney, director of the Office of Management and Budget, who was a part of the ministerial. Also, Vice President Mike Pence had strong words of warning for Turkey's President Erdogan this morning at the ministerial about Pastor Andrew Brunson. My fellow USERF Commissioner Christina Arriaga joins me for that conversation. And FRC's Travis Weber will join us as we kind of provide an overview of this week's Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom. By the way, not only is it the first ever, but it's the first annual. Secretary Mike Pompeo announcing today it'll be happening again next year. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T. Perkins. All right. As I mentioned, the Senate is going to be working through the month of August. Traditionally, that's Congress gets out of town. It's hot here in D.C. in August, and they need to get back home. But the Senate is working. They're going to be working primarily on these nominations and, in particular, the one with Brett Kavanaugh, the president's selection to replace the retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Joining us now, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa. He is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and he's going to have a very busy August. Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Yes, I'm glad to be with you. And when you say busy, I would say we're going to be able, since we're meeting in August and normally don't meet during August, we're going to continue to have hearings on the president's nominees for circuit courts and district courts. But paralleling that will be probably in August just the behind-the-scenes work of the 21 members of the Judiciary Committee plus the staff, and maybe at this point more the staff. They will be going through the at least a million pages of documents we have on Brett Kavanaugh, most of it from his work either in the Bush White House or the 12 years he's been on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. We've got to go through all of that so that we can have a hearing, hopefully early September, on his nomination, and that hearing will take up at least 1 week of September.
So that's a lengthy process, as you said. You got to comb through 12 years of his opinions, 300 of those opinions on the appellate court, the circuit court level. And so you're going through all that. Staff's got to go through that. Each senator has to be brief. Right now, he is making his rounds there on Capitol Hill, sitting down, meeting with senators. How is that going?
Well, excellent so far. And finally, at least some Democrats have been brave enough to tell Schumer we're going to meet with him. I think Schumer was, he's a Democrat leader. He was discouraging or outright demanding that no Democrats meet with him. I think that'll break down in time because they can't justify not talking to him. But before he was even selected, at least half of the Democrat caucus, which would be about 25 people, said that it didn't matter who Trump was going to appoint to the Supreme Court, they wouldn't be for it. And our hope is that we can get maybe four or five Democrats to vote for him. But we're in a kind of a ticklish situation from this standpoint that so many Democrats, I think every Democrat in my committee, for instance, is going to vote against him. They're going to vote no, but they want all these documents. Well, what more do they need to know to vote no? But they're demanding every single email during his time working for George W. Bush at the White House that may even have his name in it. So you can see that they can't find anything wrong with the qualifications of Kavanaugh to be on the Supreme Court. So they want a fishing expedition to see what they can find wrong, even though he's qualified, I suppose, to see what they can do to maybe stop it totally.
Right.
If they got one Republican to vote against him, it'd probably stop it, because we'll never, if we got five Democrat votes, it would only be after all the Republicans stuck together.
Hmm. Senator Grassley, it sounds like this is a typical play out of the Democratic playbook, and that is just to as you said, they're going to vote against him. This is just more of the delay tactics, obstructionism, that they just want to, all these documents, doesn't matter what's in the documents, they just want to eat up time to try to prevent him from being confirmed.
And let me read from a page I got in front of me, just so you know kind of what, how much is already available. If I had to summarize what I'll give you some idea of, it would add up to more documents than all the documents that we had for the five previous Supreme Court justices all added together. We're going to have more documentation on this one nominee. 939 pages from the Bush Library and the National Archives. We have 20,000 pages from his working in the Office of Independent Counsel. He submitted 111-page questionnaire that's already on the website of the Judiciary Committee, so any of your listeners can go and read his questionnaire. There were 6,148 pages that were submitted as addendum to his questionnaire. Then you already mentioned 307 opinions. We've got at least 55 records of 55 of 117 speeches he's given. We've got 35 out of 72 panels he served on. So you can see that the Senate will receive more records for Judge Kavanaugh than it did for these previous five Supreme Court nominees. And it would be five times what we had for the last Supreme Court justice, Kagan, that was in the neighborhood of about 180,000 pages.
Well, it sounds like you might wear out a few copiers to get all that stuff printed and passed around. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my guest. Senator, what I've noticed is, you know, there was, as you said, before his name was even mentioned, you had 25 Democrats pledging to oppose him. You saw a lot of hysteria in the first 48, 72 hours after his announcement, the press playing along with him. But now it seems to have died down. Doesn't seem like any of the things that they were saying are really sticking with the public.
Because they're all saying, doomsday. Every precedent of the Supreme Court dealing with social conservatism is going to be overturned. And they're never going to get any answer to that. And it's not Kavanaugh not wanting to answer the question. There's what we call the Ginsburg standard. No hints. Well, when she was asked, how are you going to vote on this particular case or that particular case? And she, back 25 years ago, she kind of set a standard for every Republican and Democrat person coming before the Supreme Court right now, when she said to the committee, I was even serving on the committee when she came before it, she said that judges, this is kind of a quote, a partial quote at least, judges are bound to decide concrete cases, not abstract issues. And she said there's not going to be, these are the exact words, no hints, no forecasts, no previews, and no special obligations, based upon somebody at that time asking her a question about how she might vote on something like that. And this is what Senator Chuck Schumer said at a press conference back in February. There is a grand tradition that I support that you can't ask a judge who's nominated for, or a potential judge who is nominated for, a judgeship about a specific case that might come before them.
Right.
But they're making a judgment that some that he's going to overturn some case that might not come before him for 10 years down the road.
Right.
Well, this gets to back to something very basic. Not only that how I judge somebody going to the Supreme Court, but this is the way any judge at any level ought to be judged, because the person before that judge is promised equal justice before the law. So that means that a Supreme Court justice or any other judge has to look at the facts of the case and the law and or the Constitution and leave their own personal views out of it. So that's the sort of a person Judge Kavanaugh is. And that's the kind of people we need on the Supreme Court. We need people that are going to interpret the Constitution the way it was originally intended, and follow precedent or what the lawyers call stare decisis, and not put themselves in the place of a congressman,
right,
by reading something in the law that the Congress didn't intend.
Which is what we've seen, and I think that's why I'm sure in your time on the Judiciary Committee you have seen the increasing volatility of the situation when a vacancy on the Supreme Court comes about. It just it is a huge fight, and this is another one of those epic battles, because the left relies on the court to do its legislating.
Yes. And that's why this is such a key course. If we have a majority that includes Kavanaugh, you're going to get legislating left to the Congress. And why that's important: if people don't like laws we pass or how we vote, they can vote us out of office.
Right.
But if a Supreme Court becomes a super legislature, they got lifetime appointments. You can't vote them out of office. It's contrary to the principles of representative government.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, Senator, we appreciate you taking time out to join us today. And as always, it's great to talk with you, Senator Grassley.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'll be glad to be with you again.
Yeah, and maybe during the month of August, we can sit down and have a glass of iced tea, since it's going to be nice and hot here in August.
Yeah, it sure will be. Goodbye.
All right, take care. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And as he said, they'll be doing a lot of the groundwork leading into the first part of September, when the actual hearing for Kavanaugh will take place. But in the meantime, there's a lot of other nominations that they will be working on. And again, just want to emphasize the importance of these nominations. And it's so critical that we get those onto the court that are, as he described, constitutional, strict constructionist, textualist, or however you want to define them, those that stick to the actual words on the paper of the Constitution, not diving into the shadows to find something they want to create. So we're going to be tracking this, obviously, very, very closely. All right, don't go away. Coming back with more Washington Watch, we're going to be joined by Mick Mulvaney. He is the director of the Office of Budget and Management, unlikely speaker at the ministerial gathering to advance religious freedom. He's passionate about it. He's going to tell us why when we come back. Don't go away. More Washington Watch to come.
You've seen the news. Christian cake bakers and florists were targeted by LGBT activists for their beliefs about marriage and forced out of business. The Christian adoption providers are also being targeted for believing that children deserve a mother and a father to raise them. In 3 states and 2 large cities, faith-based adoption providers have been forced out of providing needy children with stable homes because of their beliefs about marriage, and this trend shows no signs of stopping. With the adoption rate in the United States steadily dropping for the last 17 years, discriminating against faith-based adoption providers will only make the problem worse by forcing agencies who serve children in need of loving families out of the marketplace. This is why laws are needed to protect these agencies at the federal and state level. For more information on this important issue, visit frc.org/adoption.
Let's keep the momentum going in this fall's election by voting your values. If you're like me, you care a lot about where our culture is headed. Now is the time to stand for biblical truth and fight for faith, family, and freedom in the public square. To be equipped for this mission, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on September 21st through 23rd in Washington, D.C., and join hundreds of Americans who, like you, want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Invited and confirmed speakers at this conference include Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Laura Ingraham, Diamond and Silk, Kirk Cameron, Dana Lash, Ben Carson, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levin. On September 21st through 23rd, stand with Values voters to keep the momentum going. Visit valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808 for more information.
Hello? Can you hear me? Are we losing our voice? 69% of American adults are using social media platforms to express themselves. But digital giants like Facebook, Google, and Twitter have collided with the free speech rights of citizen internet users. In the wake of a consistent pattern of censorship by tech companies of lawful but politically incorrect viewpoints, particularly those of conservatives and Christians, what is the legal status of digital free expression? Family Research Council hosted an expert panel discussion on the question of losing our voices. Who owns free speech on the internet? The panel speakers were Congressman Marsha Blackburn, civil liberties attorney Craig Parshall, and Brent Scorum, senior research fellow in the technology policy program at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To watch this discussion on one of the most important freedom of expression issues in decades, go to frc.org/voice. Again, that's frc.org/voice.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, you got it, at T Perkins. All right, today wrapped up the first ever ministerial to advance religious freedom. This is a gathering, as we've been talking about all week, promoting religious freedom around the world. And it ended today. The Vice President spoke, Secretary of State spoke. And you had leaders from about 84 different countries that were gathered. And it ended with a number of those 80 countries pledging not just words of support, but literally actions to defend religious freedom. Now, those individual commitments followed a strong, strong pledge from Vice President Mike Pence on behalf of President Trump to advance and defend religious freedom around the globe. But one of the speakers who set the stage on day one with a stirring speech was former South Carolina Congressman Mick Mulvaney, who is now the president's director of the Office of Management and Budget. And I have to tell you, you know an administration is committed to religious freedom when the director of the Office of Management and Budget can give a stem winder of a speech on the topic of religious freedom. So I welcome now Mick Mulvaney to Washington Watch. Mick, welcome.
Tony, thank you so much for having me.
You're passionate about this, and you drew a strong contrast between this administration's commitment to religious freedom and what we've seen coming out of Washington in recent years.
Yeah, I wasn't going to go over there and speak. I've been involved in this sort of behind the scenes for a couple of years of my time on the Hill, worked with Congressman Jeff Fortenberry, Congressman Gosar on the issue of religious liberties, especially for Christian minorities around the world. But I wasn't really going to go over and get involved. But the vice president, who I've worked with since I got in the administration, asked me to go over and speak. And I said, Mr. Vice President, who cares what the budget director thinks? He goes, Mick, no. The people need to know that it's more than just, the folks who they think should be involved with religious liberties. It's everybody. So I went over to point out that even though folks didn't know who I was there on behalf of the dozens, if not hundreds, of members of this administration who care about this issue. We do discuss it every single day. We discuss it in budget matters. We discuss it in diplomatic matters. Religious liberties mean a lot to a lot of folks in the Trump administration. I hope I was able, at least in a small way, to get that across to the folks who are participating in the larger event.
Oh, Mick, I think it was crystal clear. I mean, when you look at this is look at the lineup. You've got a president who's committed to it, a vice president who lives and breathes this. You have a Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, been on this program just last week talking about this. He made the call for this ministerial. Sam Brownback, who I've known for over 20 years, he has lived and breathed this. I mean, you just go on down the line. This administration is committed to this, and this is a time in which we can get some things done.
It is. Well, it's a time that we have to make up for some past failures. The previous administration, I'm not even sure they said the right things about this issue, but they certainly didn't do anything about this issue. And I think the message went out that America didn't care about especially Christians overseas anymore. And nothing could be further from the truth. I know that it was a big deal on the House when I was a member there from 2011 through 2017. But we just had trouble breaking through with the Obama administration. They come in and say nice things to us privately. They wouldn't say much publicly, and they certainly didn't do anything. So we feel like we're sort of making up for lost time. And it was so exciting to be there today and see Mike Pompeo speak and then Vice President Pence speak and see the look on people's faces that was, and it sort of had the impression they were saying, finally, finally, it's so good to hear this from the United States of America. We need to lead on the issue. One of the things I was so excited to hear, I was talking to Brian Hook, one of the deputies at state, and he said one of the sort of unintended positive consequences of the meetings was that they had several dozen impromptu bilateral meetings with different groups who were just happened to be in town for this. So it's one of those things that America can help contribute to by leading on the issue. So it was neat to be a part of and neat to see that that things are different now that Donald Trump is president.
Yeah, and it's giving rise to other countries that are doing some things. You and I had breakfast actually this morning at the Hungarian Embassy, and Hungary has been leading out on this issue of focusing on, you mentioned this a minute ago, your commitment on the persecution of Christians, and that's what Hungary is focused on. You had a galvanizing experience in which you saw what ISIS and you heard about what ISIS was doing, and that really kind of drew you into this, not that you weren't a defender of the first freedom before, but how we have to go abroad and help the persecuted.
Yeah, it was a meeting I had in Rome a couple summers ago with a member of one of the Eastern Christian churches who are present and have been present for a long time in Syria. They've actually pointed out to me that they are the indigenous peoples in Eastern Syria. They were there before the Muslims were, and how the stories they told about the actual persecution. When I say persecution, we think that not being able to speak our minds is persecution.
Right.
Persecution there means they come into your home, demand that you either give them your daughters for the sex trade or you convert or they start shooting your children in front of you. That is persecution. That is terror. And that's something that I think that we don't fully appreciate. And thank goodness we don't fully appreciate it as Christians in the West. But the simple fact to hear their stories, you know, has to sort of motivate you. And if it doesn't stir you, it should stir you to some type of action. And again, that's why I keep coming back to why this ministerial was such a big deal, because while it was 2 days of talking, there was real action put to it. Look what just happened in Turkey yesterday. We're making progress there. Look at the commitment that we've made financially just over the last couple of days. Look at the commitment that the vice president made today, that this is going to not just be a one-time thing, this ministerial, but it's going to be an annual meeting. We are committing to the long haul on this. So we're finally starting to put actions behind our intent, and that's really a good feeling.
And Mick, I think he increased your workload. He created the International Religious Freedom Fund, which I assume you're going to be putting money into and writing checks for.
That's the stuff to write checks for. I mean,
right.
I was so moved this morning to go to breakfast with Hungary, a little tiny country, and they spent $16 million last year. But they did it so effectively that they probably have a bigger impact than countries spending 5 and 10 times as much. So there's smart ways to spend money. And that's part of my job at the Office of Management and Budget. So the neat thing about it is that my job is I take the direction of the president and the vice president. They say, I want to do X. And then they turn it over to folks like me and Mike Pompeo. And Mike figures out how to do X. And I figure out how to pay for X and do it efficiently. And so it's a team effort. But again, it's all pointed in the same direction for the first time, I think, since I've been in Washington, and that's been at least a decade now.
Oh, I think it's the first time in a long, long time, and it's refreshing, and I'm excited to see what may happen as a result of these commitments made today by the Vice President on behalf of the administration. And glad, Mick Mulvaney, there are folks like you in place, and I want to thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for getting the word out there, and thanks to the folks who listened who participated in driving these debates, because if folks back home don't care enough, then politicians don't care enough. So it really does mean a lot when folks back home get engaged. Thanks for that.
All right, folks, don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch right after this.
You've seen the news. Christian cake bakers and florists were targeted by LGBT activists for their beliefs about marriage and forced out of business. The Christian adoption providers are also being targeted for believing that children deserve a mother and a father to raise them. In 3 states and 2 large cities, faith-based adoption providers have been forced out of providing needy children with stable homes because of their beliefs about marriage, and this trend shows no signs of stopping. With the adoption rate in the United States steadily dropping for the last 17 years, discriminating against faith-based adoption providers will only make the problem worse by forcing agencies who serve children in need of loving families out of the marketplace. This is why laws are needed to protect these agencies at the federal and state level. For more information on this important issue, visit frc.org/adoption.
Let's keep the momentum going in this fall's election by voting your values. If you're like me, you care a lot about where our culture is headed. Now is the time to stand for biblical truth and fight for faith, family, and freedom in the public square. To be equipped for this mission, mark your calendar for the Values Voter Summit on September 21st through 23rd in Washington, D.C., and join hundreds of Americans who, like you, want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Invited and confirmed speakers at this conference include Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Laura Ingraham, Diamond and Silk, Kirk Cameron, Dana Lash, Ben Carson, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levin. On September 21st through 23rd, stand with Values Voters to keep the momentum going. Visit valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808 for more information.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Burkett. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T. Perkins. Okay, Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivered remarks at the concluding session. I was there this morning for the Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom. And in fact, the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announcing today that this is not just the first ever, it is the first annual. He says we're doing this again next year to great applause, as 84 countries and representatives from civil society organizations from around the world were present. And it was, in fact, there were a number of victims of religious persecution who were there. In fact, Vice President Mike Pence, during his remarks, identified and recognized many of them. But one of the big stories coming out of this week in the ministerial is yesterday, as we talked about, American pastor Andrew Brunson was released from jail to house arrest. Now, Vice President Pence, and I was communicating with his team today, they are absolutely committed to seeing Pastor Brunson back in the States free, not just in under house arrest. And this is what the vice president had to say. He had some very strong words for the Turkish president, Erdogan.
Pastor Andrew Brunson deserves to be free. If Turkey does not take immediate action to free this innocent man of faith and send him home to America, the United States will impose significant sanctions on Turkey until Pastor Andrew Brunson is free.
With us now is Christina Arriaga. She is one of my fellow commissioners at the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, and she has been working on this case of Pastor Brunson for quite some time. Christina, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
I know that you have to be encouraged. I know it's you want to see Pastor Brunson free, but he's under house arrest. But the increasing pressure that this administration is placing on Turkey has to be encouraging to you.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, right before I jumped on this call, I got a phone call from a reporter in Turkey saying, why is the government going from 0 to 100? Clearly, Turkey is getting the signal very, very that the vice president and the president are on this and they're not going to back up.
Yeah, this was not just mere saber rattling. I mean, a very specific increased sanctions. I think Turkey is feeling the pressure. But I think our listeners need to understand that Pastor Brunson is not in a safe place.
No, not at all. I spoke to someone today who actually FaceTimed with Pastor Brunson and his wife. He is waiting. He's wearing a recording or device around his leg, meaning that the wherever he is, the Turkish government can tell where he is. But also, as he was entering his home while being released, apparently there were some people cheering him on, but there were also some people shouting out things about Pastor Brunson is guilty, he shouldn't have been released. And I myself got a tweet today from a member of parliament in Turkey saying, you know that he was not in jail for religious reasons. Why are you pretending? So obviously this has turned up the volume in some places, and this could be very, very dangerous for Pastor Brunson and for his wife.
Yeah, I spoke with one of the attorneys on his case today at the ministerial, and there is security at his home, and there's efforts underway to actually enhance that. But I think the clear message, I mean, the vice president, obviously speaking on behalf of the president, he made that clear, took this forum on religious freedom to send a very strong, unequivocal, clear message to the Turkish government that they expect Pastor Brunson to be released, and they're going to hold them accountable for what happens.
Absolutely. The Turkish government has to know that they can no longer delay Pastor Brunson's release without very, very serious consequences. And these consequences, if these sanctions are put in place, the consequences will be devastating for an economy that is already in a precarious situation. And the lira, the Turkish coin, is extremely unstable, and Erdogan is desperate to stabilize the economy so that the population feel better about the fact that they just reelected him.
Now, Christina, you're in your second term on the Commission for International Religious Freedom, but you've been involved in advocacy work for a number of years. This direct confrontation with Turkey over religious freedom is going to have implications far beyond the country of Turkey, because this is sending a message to other terrorists and tyrants that America is going to defend religious freedom.
Yes, and the rumor on the street for many years in the diplomatic circles in the European Union was that the United States would never stand up to Turkey because Turkey is so key to that entire very unstable region. And the president and the vice president made it very clear today that they are going to stand up to Turkey. Of course, the entire Middle East is watching this right now to see how the United States is going to deal with this and how Turkey is going to react.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very, very critical and a real opportunity, I think, this administration is seizing to protect and promote religious freedom around the globe. Christina Arriaga, thank you so much for joining us. As always, great to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Tony.
All right, take care. Christina Arriaga, a member of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and Pastor Brunson is actually, she's adopted him as her prisoner of conscience, and she's been there in Turkey on his behalf. All right, folks, don't go away. When we come back, FRC's Travis Weber joins me as we kind of give an overview of this week's ministerial here in Washington, D.C. Don't go away.
You've seen the news. Christian cake bakers and florists were targeted by LGBT activists for their beliefs about marriage and forced out of business. The Christian adoption providers are also being targeted for believing that children deserve a mother and a father to raise them. In 3 states and 2 large cities, faith-based adoption providers have been forced out of providing needy children with stable homes because of their beliefs about marriage, and this trend shows no signs of stopping. With the adoption rate in the United States steadily dropping for the last 17 years, discriminating against faith-based adoption providers will only make the problem worse by forcing agencies who serve children in need of loving families out of the marketplace. This is why laws are needed to protect these agencies at the federal and state level. For more information on this important issue, Visit frc.org/adoption.
Let's keep the momentum going in this fall's election by voting your values. If you're like me, you care a lot about where our culture is headed. Now is the time to stand for biblical truth and fight for faith, family, and freedom in the public square. To be equipped for this mission, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on September 21st through 23rd in Washington, D.C., and join hundreds of Americans who, like you, want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Invited and confirmed speakers at this conference include Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Laura Ingraham, Diamond and Silk, Kirk Cameron, Dana Lash, Ben Carson, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levin. On September 21st through 23rd, stand with Values Voters to keep the momentum going. Visit valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808 for more information.
Hello? Can you hear me? Are we losing our voice? 69% of American adults are using social media platforms to express themselves. But digital giants like Facebook, Google, and Twitter have collided with the free speech rights of citizen internet users. In the wake of a consistent pattern of censorship by tech companies of lawful but politically incorrect viewpoints, particularly those of conservatives and Christians, what is the legal status of digital free expression? Family Research Council hosted an expert panel discussion on the question of losing our voices. Who owns free speech on the internet? The panel speakers were Congressman Marsha Blackburn, civil liberties attorney Craig Parshall, and Brent Scorum, senior research fellow in the technology policy program at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To watch this discussion on one of the most important freedom of expression issues in decades, go to frc.org/voice. Again, that's frc.org/voice.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T Perkins. Okay, this morning, the final day of the Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom took place at the State Department. I was there for the session as the Secretary of State opened the event, followed by the Vice President of the United States, putting on the table some very tangible takeaways. Now, the Secretary last week when he was on radio said this was going to be more than talk. There was going to be action associated with it. And this is some of the first comments, not all that the Vice President had to say, but here's just a couple of things he had to pledge at the very beginning of his message.
America is launching a new initiative that will not only deliver additional support to the most vulnerable communities, but we trust that it will also embolden civil society to help stop violence in the future. It's my privilege as Vice President to announce today that the United States of America will establish the Genocide Recovery and Persecution Response Program effective today.
Joining me now is Travis Weber, the Vice President for Policy here at the Family Research Council, and he's been involved with all of the activities here this week at the Ministerial. Travis, welcome back.
Thank you, Tony.
So the Vice President putting some very tangible items on the table, not only this genocide recovery fund, but also a International Religious Freedom Fund is being created as well. So they're clearly putting money in action behind the pledge to defend religious freedom.
Yeah, clearly putting money in action. And when you look at the money that's spent on so many things around the world, you know, so many international development causes, dollars dropped on this and that project, often good items. Compare that to the amount that's spent on developing religious freedom, sustaining it, not just rescuing someone, but rather cultivating the conditions for religious freedom. It's really, you know, a long overdue project to be funneling money directly into that cause, because ultimately, as we've talked about, we focused on here at FRC, and we understand religious freedom helps cultivate national security. It helps cultivate economic prosperity. So if you want those things to happen, and they, if you don't, you know, have them happy, you're going to spend a lot of money on them. Why not spend the money on religious freedom? So I think this makes sense, and this is a logical step. Many good, you know, I think outcomes from this conference, the mere fact that it's being held, but certainly some of these tangible focal points are significant and I think very welcome.
And as I mentioned earlier, the Secretary of State announced in his remarks that this was not going to be just the first ever, but it is going to be the first annual, and that this would be taking place every year, this gathering of international leaders to talk about and put solutions on the table when it comes to religious persecution. And after the vice president spoke and left, then there's a general session with all of the delegates around where they individually began to, they had 5 minutes to make comments and pledges based upon what their country was going to do. So several countries stepped up, said they were those that did not have an ambassador at large for religious freedom, they would be doing that, creating institutes for religious freedom. So the United States has really got the ball rolling on this issue.
This is very significant. I think, you know, urging other countries to create a point person position on this issue matters. Just this morning, I was spending some time with Canada's former ambassador at large, Father Andrew Bennett. He's mm-hmm. been an advocate for that country on this issue. And we were talking through some things. It's very significant that you have the signal sent of the importance on the issue when you have a country appoint a person in that role, and also their work. You know, Ambassador Lars Brownback can coordinate across agencies on this issue because this issue is his focus and his job. He's not distracted by other matters, and you can more effectively bring the whole government apparatus to bear on this issue. So it's very welcome that we're going to have ongoing meetings on this. Complementing that, I think you have a lot of the advocates who are encouraged by this. They're going to have their own ongoing meetings and work with the governments who are focused on it. And really need to encourage people towards action and towards keeping a focus on this issue, not letting it slip from their minds. You know, there's going to be a lot of issues competing for folks' attention, but this beyond people's minds as they go about their daily lives, praying for those who face religious freedom problems and just being thoughtful about how they can act day to day.
Travis Weber, my guest, he's the Vice President of Policy here at the Family Research Council. We're talking about the Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom. And actually, I need to stop for just a moment because I got some questions about, you know, the ministerial. What is that? What does it mean? Well, it's a gathering of foreign ministers. The United States is probably the only country in which we call our Secretary of State a Secretary of State. In most countries, it's a Minister of Foreign Affairs or along those lines. And so the ministerial is a gathering of these ministers, and this is the first time there's been a call from the United States for these ministers of state to gather to talk about religious freedom. Now, this is done by the State Department, prompted by and called by the Secretary of State. So there's been other gatherings of ministers, foreign ministers, but not on this topic. So this is why it's so significant. They've gathered to talk about, you know, everything else under the sun, but never religious freedom. And so that's why this was so important. And there were 84 representatives from various governments, which is quite significant for the first. And I would not be surprised to see that number grow significantly by next year for the next gathering.
You know, I agree. You know, and I think it seems like what they're trying to do here, the United States is trying to do, is almost create a NATO of religious freedom of sorts.
Yeah.
Who can agree with us? Who broadly can agree with us? There's going to be some differences, but who can we band together with as we present a united front to China, North Korea, Iran, et cetera? And then that'll grow. You know, have countries like Uzbekistan making some steps towards religious freedom.
And then they pledged some activity today.
And that's an example of a country that, you know, we would say, let's encourage them in the right direction in a variety of ways, right? And others, we want to try to bring them along in that way too. So, you know, I think it's really encouraging, and there are many, many cases of religious freedom violations around the world, overall situations we want to improve. But we always want to strive towards a position where everyone's free to choose how they're going to worship and live that out, live out their faith in a robust manner. We want that to be protected everywhere around the world, and that's really what we want to strive towards.
You know, I was I played the clip earlier with the vice president directly challenging Turkey over Pastor Brunson. But I was, frankly, I was a little surprised at, although, I mean, the administration has been strong, so I'm not suggesting that they're not strong, but the vice president was calling countries out today in this format, which I thought was pretty bold and shows how serious they are over the religious freedom issue. They called out I mean, we talked about Turkey, but they called out some of the other countries that have been abusing. I mean, they talked about China.
Yeah.
They talked about North Korea. I mean, the obvious offenders, but they went beyond. They started talking about Europe, talked about the anti-Semitism in Europe, in France, and in the UK.
Yeah, and there are some problems there. You know, increasing anti-Semitism, Jews no longer feeling safe in Europe. This is really problematic. We know European history, and they're having to go back to Israel just to be safe. I mean, this is troubling. Talking about calling countries out, we know when President Trump raised the issue of religious freedom directly with President Buhari of Nigeria, there was a response from that. Right now, Nigeria has ongoing problems, but raising the issue directly with him in a public manner was effective. And you know, we really need to stay on this issue of Nigeria and the conditions there. Talking about ongoing issues, I think of the case of Raymond Koh in Malaysia. This man was abducted off the street. We don't know what's happened. We have no answers from the Malaysian government. Abducted off the street. And what we do know is that he was ministering and sharing his faith in Malaysia. And there's a lot of social hostility to people converting away from Islam and choosing Christianity. He shouldn't face repercussions for that. He should be free to share his faith and live out his faith in Malaysia. And this is a situation where we need to bring attention, bring a spotlight on the Malaysian government demanding answers, and people need to understand what happened to him and to pay attention to the situation until he's found or released or we have some answers there.
Right. And Mike Pompeo began by making reference to the fact that this is the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was adopted in 1948. Created by the UN in 1948. I think originally 48 countries signed it, but now I think 165 or something along those lines. So almost every civilized country has signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That really is the benchmark when we talk about religious freedom. Because it goes into great detail what that actually means.
Right, right. The freedom to choose a faith and to manifest that faith, right? And manifesting one's faith broadly is similar to our First Amendment, different language, but the same concept. The freedom to live out your faith publicly in the public square, and you're not sort of secluding and hiding it off in your house somewhere, being cloistered off in church. So very, very significant. On this point of the UDHR, yesterday, I actually interacted with Mr. Malik, the son of Charles Malik, who was behind the drafting of the UDHR. At when the document was put to paper, it was very significant. I really enjoyed that interaction because it was a kind of bringing me back to the point of connection with the legal world as a believer, wanting to see what we know about God creating man in His image. And the rights that flow from that being put to paper, very significant that he was at this event, be able to interact with him and to emphasize in that side event on legal protections for religious freedom, the importance of human rights in the UDHR, Article 18 on religious freedom, which you've testified in regard to before Congress a number of times, being the international standard for how we're going to approach religious freedom worldwide.
Yeah, I just want to read this for our listeners. This is Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And this really is – words have meaning, and definitions are important, especially when we're talking about religious freedom. In fact, this came up at a breakfast you and I were at this morning. I mentioned earlier with Mick Mulvaney. He was there. We were sitting next to each other, small breakfast at the Hungarian embassy. And it was brought up that, some people are working with a different definition of religious freedom, especially in the Middle East. But here's the definition that these countries have signed on to, and it's Article 18. It says, everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief, and freedom either alone or in community with others and in public or private to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. The real sticking point here is where we have, a real challenge, especially in some of the countries in the Middle East, is the freedom to change religion or belief.
Yeah, no, I agree, Tony. And we can kind of observe this broadly in a lot of heavily Islamic cultures and some Hindu countries too. We've spoken about anti-conversion laws. There's an ongoing case of seven Christians who appear to be wrongfully convicted in India for supposedly killing a Hindu leader just because of the fact that they were Christians, wrongfully convicted And this is all part of the anti-conversion law push in India, across a lot of the Islamic world, the Middle East, Pakistan. Big problems with apostasy laws, blasphemy laws, punishing people for either offending God allegedly or converting away from Islam. Right now, Asia Bibi sits in prison in Pakistan on some allegations related to this, all related to the notion of opposition to the notion of people being able to freely choose their faith. And that goes for everyone, every religion free to choose, but it has to be applied equally, and everyone needs to be equally protected within the same governmental system. Very significant point. You know, people come to me privately and they talk about these challenges and how to work towards them. So we want to partner with everyone who wants to aim towards this definition, all anchored in Article 18.
Travis Weber, before we run out of time here in the program, I want to kind of tie this together for our listeners, because I know we've every day this week we've talked about it. We talked about it last week. And frankly, we're going to keep talking about religious freedom and the persecuted church and other religious minorities that are being persecuted. And there's a reason. There's a reason that Christians in America should be concerned about this, that this is not something that, quite frankly, we can ignore any longer. And it's important that we understand what happens when as we talked about actually today at the breakfast, when our faith becomes so private because we're pushed out of the public square, on the other side of that, or just around the corner from that, comes the persecution. And that's what we've seen in other parts of the country and parts of the world, and why it's so important that here in the United States, as we reach out and advocate for those being persecuted, and we talk persecution, we're talking about being executed, we're talking about their homes being destroyed. We're talking about rapes. We're talking about just atrocities. We need to speak up for them. And that's a reminder to ourselves of how valuable freedom this is and why we must defend it here.
Absolutely true. You know, and it comes down to this. If some of these people are willing to face death for their faith, for our Lord Jesus, and they're willing to stand there and face death because of their faith, how are we afraid of taking a public stand for our faith in this country, being called names on Twitter or in school by classmates, by colleagues, or facing opposition, social ostracization? Their example is an example to us to stand publicly for our faith and not be afraid of that. This is very significant because I think as people practice this, you get used to it. It becomes more acceptable. It becomes okay. And then we realize it's part of a vibrant faith standing publicly.
Right. Well, as you and I have talked about, this is a narrow window of opportunity that for some reason God has entrusted us with an administration that is not just supportive of religious freedom, but advancing religious freedom. We have to do all that we can to advocate for, speak for, work for, help those being persecuted, as well as preserving the freedoms we enjoy here for future generations. Travis Weber, as always, great to have you on the program.
Thanks, Tony.
All right, folks. Out of time for today, but I want to thank you for joining us. And I do want to encourage you to pray. Pray for the persecuted church. Pray for Pastor Brunson. And in the coming days, I'm actually put up for us here. We'll have it on the website coming up. Prisoners of Conscience, that I will be working and advocating for at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And I'm going to challenge you to join me in praying for those. But until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, you've prayed, prepared, and taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.